This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to The Bigger Picture with me, Lee Chui Lin. Simply put, occupational therapy is all about helping people to live better or to regain their lives of old. However, in practice, it's rather more complicated. Professor Sharon Britnell, president of the World Federation of Occupational Therapists, gives us her perspective on the profession. Professor Sharon, firstly, what exactly is occupational therapy?
That is always the question I'm asked, and I'm pleased to say that occupational therapy relates to everything that everyone is doing in their life. We use occupation, or the other word is activity, as the intervention and as the assessment. So it is something that just takes your daily life pattern, looks at it, and if you've had an illness, an injury, a disability of some kind, do our best to use those activities as the treatment to return you to the most independent stage we can.
And when doing research for this set of questions, a lot of stuff came up about the history of occupational therapy, and that's quite long and storied, and it's quite interesting. Could you share some of it with us?
Oh, I'm delighted. Occupational therapy started around World War I, and it began in Canada and the United States simultaneously, with the same people advising the Canadians and the Americans. It started with soldiers' civil reestablishment in Canada. It was about returning soldiers to the community and making sure they could earn a livelihood. The word rehabilitation wasn't a part of it. It also was a period in time when arts and crafts movement was very much a part of society. So, and apprentice models were the ones used for work. So those were the activities that were used as the modalities of treatment. So you'll see wonderful pictures of soldiers weaving baskets, woodworking, using looms, because each of those things were assisting them either use their hands, organize their thinking, or plan. And so you have this wonderful engagement in things that are found at that time everywhere. Now we kind of consider those arts and crafts, but we use activities of daily living, which can be anything that anyone has to do. So our history really is long. It predates some of the medical specialties that we work with, and it has with it a very practical and pragmatic focus.
So was there always a holistic view of a person then? Because while I was looking through it, you know, there was a lot of talk of which philosophies it was kind of based on at that point in time. However, it appears that, you know, from then till now, it's always taken quite a holistic point of view of a person and their activities.
I'm really pleased with that question because the beginning of OT in this period, in 1919, there's this wonderful picture of a triangle, and it says on its side, mind, body, and spirit. So the answer to the question, absolutely. It was holistic, and it was about this individual who had responsibilities, a big picture. Not a little picture about a hand that didn't work or perhaps a mind that wasn't thinking. In those days, they called it shell-shocked, which we now say post-traumatic stress. And unfortunately, as the evolution of the profession over the last 100 years, after World War II, we got into the remedial models and a biomechanical model, which for a period of time kind of lost that holistic perspective. Then in the late 70s, you had a resurgence of returning to a more complete understanding of a client-centered, which I was very much a part of in the Canadian workplace and in education, of reintroducing the mind, body, and spirit, and a client-centered perspective. So it is a unique feature of occupational therapy.
And now a question that I'm sure you get a lot, because it's a question that I hear, you know, very, very often. What is the difference between occupational therapy and physiotherapy?
Well, I sit here originally educated as both a physical and an occupational therapist. And that was a model that was used in Canada in the 50s. I think it's something that people have to be very careful about, because every now and then there's a resurgent that we can turn out this combined therapist. Well, the experiment was tried and it was a failure. It was a failure because the curriculum had three quarters in the physical and one quarter in the psychosocial. And you had a group of graduates for a number of years that tended to be physical therapists because it's concrete. It's because it's very understandable. You put the hands on, you do massage, you do manipulations, you use physical modalities to stimulate. There is something very visible and manipulative that people can identify with. Occupational therapies does use objects, but the objects, as we just discussed, are the teacup, the pot in the kitchen, the transfer to the toilet, the transfer to the bed, the dressing, or it's about how the mind plans and organizes, how the executive functioning is necessary to do complex tasks. And so the OT sets up a series of things to do. It might be an arts and crafts. It may be organizing a jigsaw puzzle. It may be cooking a meal in the kitchen. So OT always has a very functional daily living outcome. If you look at the literature in physical therapy, their domain is mobility. So they use components. So they use exercises that looks at range, muscle strength. Occupational therapy will look at the use of the limb in its totality.
And in practical living.
In practical living. So you can walk into a session that I do, often I work with veterans, and you'll see us drinking a cup of tea.
Successfully.
Yeah.
And what kind of education do you need to become a fully qualified and certified occupational therapist? You spoke there about a model that I assume is now outdated.
Yes. The biomedical remedial method is one part of our practice. And you have to have a range of educational theories, because we take our base, if you look at mind, body, and spirit. The spirituality is coming from anthropology and from religious studies. The body parts is coming from the biomedical clinical area. And the mind, we've got psychology, anthropology, and sociology to come. So all of those theories merge and prepare us for the occupational therapy interpretation. So we borrow theory, but we create our own. And our own theory is about the use of activity. What are the normal patterns of a person's life? And then when someone has had an illness or a stroke or a disability, we compare their current status to what it was before. And then we look to approximating activities that allow them to re-engage with the satisfaction and the motivation that they had before. So you get that combination, and that really requires now a degree-based program. We talk about it as our professional reasoning or clinical reasoning. There are models of education that are the old school diploma, and those therapists that have diplomas are experts because they have experience now. They have learned on the job, which was the original apprentice model. Now we have to fast track people to deal with the complex people that are presenting, who are living longer with a disability, who want to stay at home and be a part of their family. And that requires that problem solving be a key part, and that the clinical reasoning of that holistic perspective is the real skill set. It isn't information anymore.
You're the president of the World Federation of Occupational Therapists. What exactly is that organization?
The World Federation of Occupational Therapists is the global voice of the profession. We exist as a profession because we are local. as we are in Malaysia, as we go nationally and as we go internationally. And we have the whole spectrum. The organization was started in 1952. It's fashioned after the UN. And our constituencies are primarily the World Health Organization and all those agencies like UNESCO that deal with health education or social issues. In 2011, there was a very important document produced called the World Report on Disability, co-sponsored by WHO and the World Bank. And it was a seminal document because it really captured for the first time in a systematic and scientific way the issues relating to disability in the community. And the themes that came out of that is that approximately 15% of every population has a group of people with a form of disability. Now, that disability has also changed. It isn't people who were born with a particular disorder like cerebral palsy or spina bifida or mentally handicapped. It's people like you and I who somewhere in the midstream of our life have a car accident and end up with brain damage, or a mental stress disorder, many in the workplace. And those disabilities may be partial, and they may be for a short period of time. So the type of disability is both permanent and temporary, and there's a range across the lifespan and a range across the actual events, such that WHO is changing some of its perspectives on disability.
Because what you're saying essentially then is that a population could be moving in and out of that 15% group at any given point in
time. Absolutely.
Right.
Very, very well said.
I'm speaking today to Professor Sharon Brintnell, who is the president of the World Federation of Occupational Therapists. And we're talking, of course, about occupational therapy. Coming up, we find out the importance of having an occupational therapist in medical or health settings on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin, and I'm joined today by Professor Sharon Brintnell. She's the president of the World Federation of Occupational Therapists, and we're exploring that profession that so often is a little understood or ignored in place of physiotherapy. We've been talking about the practicality of what an occupational therapist does. Now, what is the importance of having an occupational therapist in a medical or health setting, you know, say in a hospital or a clinic?
I think one of the major aspects of it is that when people leave hospital, they go home to do something. They have a role to play. They have habits that they have. Many of them want to resume who they were. Their identity has been affected, either short-term or long-term. And it is the occupational therapist who starts from the moment they make contact. You plan the discharge from the moment of contact. Where does this person have to go? What are the things that are important in their life? Who are they? What makes up their life? Who's their family? And these things then shape the interventions. If a man is, say, with a stroke, well, there's no point teaching him to cook, because if he goes home, we assume there is his wife. But in many cases, that may be a working wife, and maybe then he has to know how to make a sandwich. So his interaction in that way would be enough to lessen the burden on his wife, who will be the caregiver, make him feel independent while he's in this stage of treatment, and therefore affects some change. That's just a simple example. So the OT thinks about the discharge. It thinks about the community. And the other thing about it is that there's some good research that to say that kind of thinking and contribution of function reduces the length of stay. And that relates to the business model of health. Reduced length of stay, better outcomes, which means that people are not constantly using the system, that they are more independent, and not only are more important, they feel more important. You reestablish that self-efficacy, that ability. I can do this. I may be a little different. I've got a wheelchair. There's no reason why I can't go to the mall.
And it's a very broad specialty. What kind of scope do occupational therapists have? At what point does it pass out from your purview?
The point that I think we make, and it's a very good one, because we can think OTs do a lot of things. We're usually in a system. People that come to us because they've been identified with some need. And so the health system allows us a certain amount, depending on the country. There can be fixed times, or the discharge plan is made and the outcomes are achieved. So at that point, they're no longer with us. Now, they could go to the community, and the WHO is promoting community-based care. And I know there's some considerations here in Malaysia, but it is more cost-effective. You don't have the infrastructure supports. Not only that, the interventions, as we call them, the needs of that person in their home, in their community, is much more tailored then to a real situation rather than the hypothetical that you would have in a hospital setting. So they can be picked up again through a home care consult. We designed at my university a thing called a smart condo. It's using high technology, a lot of devices, some of them very common, to fit out an environment that has safety supports. When do you take your medication? You haven't moved around. There's no sounds. And so people who live alone, who may be having cognitive impairment or may have an accident, can use the technology to assist them. It also has all the lifts and things. So there is that opportunity to go in and do environmental scans, which may be a one-off. We go to the workplace where somebody is returning from acute care, and then work with the employer and the employee to reintroduce them to their job. It may be a new job. It may be an adaptation or accommodation in their old job. So you get the work environment. The other big one where we can pick up people that we've not seen before and starting early is in the school system. Many countries recognize that you have to mainstream, particularly children with disabilities, because if you don't, the world report says that people with disability are the poorest, they have the least education, they are marginalized, they suffer from stigma, and if you have a mental disorder, you're more than likely to have a physical, and if you have a physical, you're more than likely to have a mental. One of the ways to deal with all of that is early intervention, early detection. The school system is children's work. And you'll find OTs either as consultants or working full-time with a school board. And they're the ones that help teachers in special education program the environment and the particular tasks to fit the level of the child. Many children with a disability have no intellectual impairments, but they have a lot of physical impairments that preclude them doing things in the classroom the way that other children do.
How do you do all this in as unobtrusive a way as possible? Because, you know, for somebody who is returning, I'm just imagining somebody who's returning who's physically changed, for example, from acute injury. And
A burn,
for instance, an amputation. And these are people who would already be feeling self-conscious, who may already be feeling less than themselves. And to have somebody there assisting them with things as basic as typing, you know, for instance, how do you kind of do that?
Well, there's two parts of that, and it's an area of return to work. Some countries have a very sophisticated approach. Australia does. Canada has a model called disability management, not a good term. But there, the model is the employers in their employee assistance programs are working with their staff all the time to support them before there is a problem. They provide mental health programs, wellness, diet, lots of things. And also with that, it's a common expectation if something happens physically that we will intend to bring you back to work. So you've got this environment that is being prepared. And then with the particular individual, some of those things might be worked on individually, skill sets, while they're in the rehabilitation mode. But the rehabilitation mode moves to the workplace as soon as possible. So some of the learning has gone on before, the practice goes on in the workplace. You would introduce the return. Joe's coming back. We're looking forward to working them. And again, if there is some visible disabilities, the challenge is more often with the people with the invisible one, the mental health issues. Physically, people can understand there's been a change. With a mental health issue, you were away, you had time off, you're back, so why can't you do it like you did it before? And that's a much longer preparation of the workplace, but there's strategies to deal with that too.
Talk us through your initial assessment with a client. You know, so you meet somebody, what do you need to consider and what do you need to take note of?
Well, first of all, like any profession, occupational therapy has a lot of tools and paper and pencil tests and other things. But our greatest asset is our interpersonal relationship with that person. And we call it client-centered therapy because you, with your disability, know yourself more than anything. And one of the important things is to find out who you are, what you want to do, and how we can go about it. So that relationship is the very key thing. We may do a simple inventory of exploration if we don't have a history. We build on other people's work because the healthcare system needs to share. And then we focus on those things particularly relating to the day-to-day living. What did you do before? What kind of a job do you have? What are your responsibilities at home? Are you married? Do you have children? So that social and work history becomes a very important component when you and I decide what it is that you want to work on.
You were mentioning earlier interventions.
Yes. Could
you explain what that means exactly? Because that's quite an aggressive sounding word.
Okay. An intervention is a social domain word that is replacing the word treatment. Frequently, there is no cure in a lot of the conditions that we see. They are long-standing, and that relates to neurological conditions, long-standing, rheumatoid arthritis, arthritic conditions, diabetes. So there are a lot of what in the medical area we call chronic disorders. And when you say treatment, there is a connotation of cure, that you're going to go get the treatment and then you're going to be all better. So the word intervention means at some point you're intervening, you're disrupting the system, and you're going to offer alternatives that will mitigate or lessen the effect and offer strategies that will increase the ability to look at the performance, be it in the areas that we look at are self-care, all the things you do to get yourself up, dress, feed yourself, go to the bathroom. It also means some of the cognitive things of planning and organization. Then there is productivity, because some people aren't remunerated. They're not paid. They're volunteers, depending on your age. And children's work is school. So I like the word productivity rather than work. And the last area is recreation or leisure. What do you do for yourself? That isn't always being active. It isn't about going to the gym. It's sometimes just relaxing.
Reading,
sitting quietly and having some time, being reflective. So all of those things take on a very individualized area. So we pick a strategy which will change the way that you've been limited and try and reintroduce those things that are so important to you.
And you've mentioned the word habit quite a lot, because we are, of course, I think almost without exception, creatures of habit. So that being said, changing a person's habits or getting them accustomed to doing something in a new way can be difficult. I think even if you tell the average person now, to just wake up at a different time tomorrow, it can be strange. How do you get these interventions to stick?
Well, the first thing you do is you match them to the old habits. There is some theories in occupational therapy, and there's one in particular called the model of human occupation, and one of its constructs is habits. So habits can be very powerful, positive things, because when they're a habit, they're automatic. or they're without thinking. We do those things. There are rituals that we use in our life. Re-engaging in those things can have a soothing effect. There's a level of confidence that can be there. Now, we try and re-establish that, but use some adaptations so that it isn't a completely new habit. But with some things, you are habit training. There's a wonderful book called The Outliers, and it says anybody can be exceptional if you have 10,000 hours of practice. So at a certain level, we all perform very well, where you've got the intellectual and the physical capacity. And the thing that discriminates is practice. It's the same in therapy. I don't know if we can always get 10,000 hours, but we practice to the level of confidence is built, till the experimenting. We're tinkerers. Occupational therapist is a wonderful word, tinkering. You know, we play with things. We play with work. We play with tools to see which one works, which strategy works best. And so we create an adaptation to that habit. But habits are very strong core. Habits can have a negative side too, and we see that in substance abuse.
And what changes might you need to make to a patient's space? We talked earlier about the smart condo. So that's obviously quite, you know, an innovative way of doing it, but it's also very immersive. That's everything being different. But generally speaking, when you enter a person's home and they're returning from something, what kind of changes do you
need
to make?
Pick up the rugs. People trip. Even young people, if their gait has been altered through a neurological disorder or even orthopedic, you trip over the carpet, especially if it's what we call throw carpets. So that's one thing you might do very quickly. You declutter. You go in. It seems very common sense, but you know it's not very common sense. Also, for people with mobility issues, you may have to put a ramp into the building. Some buildings are inaccessible. Certainly, now there's a general awareness by governments and building codes to make buildings accessible, but some people still live in places that aren't. So that environment, you can do some very simple things, lowering counters, using a stool to sit.
What about things like doors?
Doors, absolutely. A lever handle is easier than a turn handle. Sometimes you can't make large structural. You might have to take the door off and put up a curtain. You try and maintain the normalcy so it doesn't look like a specially constructed place. But the viewpoint of the OT is to scan that environment and then look where the critical parts and then make some suggestions.
So you mentioned earlier also that probably one of the most critical things with an assessment is building that relationship and having it. Could you just give us the details of it? What is an ideal relationship, I guess, between an occupational therapist and a client? What would be the best?
It's one where you've built up trust and that the therapist is demonstrating good listening skills. When we talk about that relationship, I often open to saying, I'm delighted to meet you, and do you know why you're here? And we go through that. And I said, well, you know yourself better than anyone. Tell me first about yourself, and what is it that you want to be able to do? So from the very moment I am listening, and unfortunately in our medical system sometimes people think they're having things done to them. And everybody's busy, and there isn't anyone listening. So one of the key first thing is to get that sense of listening and being reflective, and the person is involved in the decision-making. Now, having said that, if they knew all the answers, they wouldn't need to come to me. So I have some professional judgment, and I have some expertise. And every now and then, there has to be some negotiating. You may want to do something that I know in my experience is very difficult or perhaps not
possible.
And I'm not going to say no. I'm probably going to say, well, let's see if we can work there and we'll see how far we can get. And then maybe we'll have to make some changes. But for the beginning, that first path is pretty similar.
Or it's a hope you might need to have to adapt, I suppose, if anything.
But once you've gone through the process and your experience, I think a classical example, I have never met anybody, and I work with some, upon having a spinal cord injury, doesn't say, I'm going to walk out of here. And, of course, that's what we want for all people. And some of the newer strategies perhaps produce that. But the majority of them have residual issues. So you don't destroy that. That's hope. And hope is a very important element. We a lot of research done on hope. It is that moment that carries us over the barriers. It's the moment that takes us through the despondency. And so you never say no.
I was reading about your current research and I found it very, very interesting because it involves looking at the transition from jail to community. Can you tell me more about that? Because I think that's fascinating. I'm especially interested in terms of how one would learn to manage their time.
Well, there's a couple of viewpoints. First of all, I was particularly dealing with people who were suspected of having a fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. And for your audience, those are people whose mother drank or during the pregnancy at some time. And they have a brain impairment. Now, the interesting thing is they can have normal intelligence, normal group, but there's also a group that are severely impaired. But all of them have some form of executive impairment. So there is an actual brain impairment that is due to the alcohol early in the pregnancy.
What kind of impairment does that usually produce, though? I mean,
Executive organization planning, impulsivity, short attention span, to the point of they may present as being an attention deficit type disorder, or at some of the lower ends, they may present as being mentally handicapped. And the only way you can confirm this, there's is quite a rigorous diagnostic process. You have to know that the mother was
drinking.
That's one of the key things. There are some possible secondary confirmation. But the whole project was to do how many people, there is a suspect that some of the people with high recidivism rates going back into jail are either mentally ill or have FASD. And so the project was to take a sample to determine how many of them were, but then to support them in making that transition to the community. Because what you want to do is, again, the jail is just like the health system. It's a high cost to lock people up. And if you have an atmosphere or a philosophy in corrections or prisons, whichever the term, of punishment, then there isn't any remedial action going on while they are incarcerated. And our group was in there for an average of 132 days. So, you know, you've got 3 or 4 months. They may have a psychiatric disorder. They may have an addiction. You can do interventions. You can do some interventions during that period. You can do some lifestyle explorations.
Especially in a controlled environment.
And that's where they do the best because they're regimented, they're structured, there are all the right reasons for them to learn new things. But many of prison systems have cut out the activities that used to go on. They would have a lot of work-related activities, the prisoners that contributed, and depending on the philosophy of the system, and I'm happy to say there's been some enlightenment now, the state of Pennsylvania in the United States has just done a massive restructuring, recognizing if you want the behavior to change in the community and the criminal behavior to stop, then you've got to give them some skills on the inside. Unfortunately, with the FAS population, they're so easily influenced by their environment, by the people around them. So what you're trying to do is give them, first of all, the thinking process to change, and then we introduced what we call a transition advocate. It's somebody who meets them while they're in prison and helps them to navigate re-entering the community. So you get safe housing, you have programs to go to, you have any more medical treatment that you may do. So they lose their way in the first 36 to 48 hours.
Hmm.
So other kinds of prisoners have other issues, but it's very common sense. If you don't have any other skills and you have to earn a living, you're going to go back to the ways of your previous life.
Because it worked for you up until a certain point.
And for a short period of time, you had a lot of money.
Right.
And you may prefer to spend a cold winter in jail, in my climate.
So you were working with that particular group then and looking at how they returned, mm-hmm. I suppose, to mainstream community. Mm-hmm. All right. And you're also known for your expertise in curriculum design. What considerations go into designing courses for occupational therapy? I mean, even just from our conversation alone, it's wide-ranging. You do lots and lots of things. You help many different groups of people. So how do you kind of craft things to accommodate all these different needs?
Well, the first thing is that most people think that a curriculum is a series of courses. You take one, you take two. But a curriculum is a much more integrated, interdependent flow of knowledge and practice. So the design of a curriculum is a very complex thing. We borrow theory initially, as we were talking before when I talked about mind, body, and spirit. But then it gets into, we do a lot of problem-based learning. So there are case studies. There are also a lot of practicums. We use simulated patients to role play, and our students also practice on one another. So you have there's a group of learning called Bloom's taxonomy, and there's the cognitive domain about the thinking, and then there's the affective domain, which is the feeling part of learning, and the last part is the psychomotor. And occupational therapists, as I said, are tinkerers. So you will see they perform those tests while they're in the educational process. The information through occupational therapy textbooks is already integrated for them in a way that reflects all of these components of anthropology and the socializing. But the student then is required through their own analysis in the case to show by using some of our models. I was part of the contributors to the Canadian model, and it speaks of mind, body, and spirit. It speaks about the physical domain, the affective domain, and also the element of the environment, and spirituality is in the center. So the student originally starts with saying, this is client X. What are the issues relating in the physical domain? What are those that relate to the environment? And through that analysis, they get a static picture. Then the next thing is to look, what is the interaction? How is the physical and the affective affecting one another? Or the cognitive, obviously. Most people think about thinking. The other part of it is this interaction with the environment. So you have the person with mind, body, and spirit now interacting in a place. And what are the elements in place? Is it an institutional? Are the rules and regulations affecting? Is it about the culture? And so you get this very complex arrangement that the students go through and then come up with their analysis of where the issues are. It's better when we can have a real person because they identify their issues and we do it in reverse. So it's I think most importantly, it's not just the information, it's the way we're very constructivist in our learning. It's an active learning model.
And for young therapists, young occupational therapists who've been through all this and now are entering the job market, is there a great demand for the occupation worldwide?
We're growing exponentially. Certainly, many, many parts of the world are starting occupational therapy education programs where we haven't had them before. Southeast Asia has always had a tradition, but more are growing in some of the countries. I was responsible starting programs in Indonesia. There are at least three programs now. And as we see it growing here in Malaysia, you have again, your systems have public and privates. So there is both that. And as I said, the World Federation of Occupational Therapists is the only health profession that actually approves curriculum. So we have an international standard of education. Not all programs apply for that approval, which is unfortunate because buyer beware. Students enroll in programs that are not at an international standard. They don't know that when they're enrolling, and they may not get the wide range of skills that
they need.
They need. And then what happens, people have a bad experience, and they say, well, I had an OT, and it wasn't. So one of the things I think people need to be is they should be a graduate of a World Federation-approved school. It's quality assurance.
Having said that, what brings you to Malaysia?
Well, the Malaysian Association has invited me to come. They're in the reviewing now of practice. You have had an election. There's an opportunity now with the health system to look at what are the needs of Malaysian society. Given what we talked about disability, you have an aging society. You had a phenomenal conference here last year on healthy aging. We know that we don't need to medicalize aging. People are aging normally. They may have a medical condition. So there is a real need. And as we talked about disability and chronic disorders, so when you look at the profile of Malaysia and you look at the health and social needs, there is a whole range of individuals who could benefit from occupational therapies, forms of interventions to keep them in the community, let alone the people we see in the hospital. So the profession is re-examining itself. It's looking at its educational programs. There are some intentions to offer another degree program. We have to look at the diplomas. Are they doing a good enough job in preparing them for the more complex kinds of clients that we're facing? Notice I use the word client, because in a social model we talk about clients because they're not patients.
Right.
When they're in the hospital, they're patients.
What would your final message be on the subject of occupational therapy?
Well, I think it's one of the most exciting, innovative professions. It is one that truly, I think, has the individual as part of the partnership and planning. And it proves itself to have some very effective outcomes. It can reduce length of stay, and it can increase function, which lessens the burden on the rest of us for our tax dollars. So it's a good investment.
All right. Thank you, Professor.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I've been speaking to Professor Sharon Brintnell. She's the president of the World Federation of Occupational Therapists, and we've been discussing occupational therapy and what it's all about right here on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.